This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, the risks of overusing hand sanitizers. But first, this past Tuesday would have been the 90th birthday of the late civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And on Monday, our nation honors him, including several events across the state. And our first guest today will be a keynote speaker at an event happening in Bismarck. Joseph McNeil Jr. joins us from our Bismarck studio. Joseph, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. We appreciate it.
You will be speaking on Monday, the 21st at 7 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck. This is part of the Martin Luther King Observance. And you were chosen for a very specific reason, and that is the work of your father. Who is Joseph McNeil Sr. to you?
Well, Joseph McNeil Sr., well, he's my father, of course. but moreover, I've watched throughout my years of people coming up to him, trying to glean something from him as what helped him, what sparked him, what he thinks now of current events today. And that still goes on in his life, all based on the actions that he took when he was 18 years old and a very personal stance that he took for his own manhood. He found comrades, comrades at the school he was going to at North Carolina A&T that felt the same and would stand with him or sit with him as it is. At the Woolworths counter, and how do they strategize to make it effective?
Well, take us to February 1st, 1960. What did your father and three of his friends do?
My father, with Frank McCain, Ezell Blair, and David Richmond, they were all students at North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, North Carolina. And days before the 1st, they were strategizing as to how they can be served at the segregated lunch counter at the Woolworth station and at the Woolworth store in Greensboro, North Carolina. And so studying Gandhi, nonviolent protests, and the work of Martin Luther King and other activities that were going on during the time, they didn't want it to be a fight and a flare and over. So how do they make it stick was really the task at hand. So they thought to themselves, we need to be customers first.
Mm-hmm.
So they made a very specific strategy. They're going to go into the store because they can go in the front door of the store to buy products at Woolworth, but they couldn't eat at the counter. They would have to go to the back of the store to get food. So as paying customers, they made their point initially that they were paying customers first. They took their products and sat at the counter. And they waited. And they waited. And the management didn't know what to do because here all of a sudden are four young men that were not supposed to be sitting there and are sitting in there as customers, paying customers at the store and were asking for service. So this was a great challenge for the establishment that day as to what could they do?
And that day, February 1st, 1960, it was the four people. Just a couple of days later, it's in the hundreds and then the thousands as people joined into this youth-led movement.
Very much so. It really exploded. And as we know, in anything that occurs like Instagram and Facebook and the internet, everything expands your knowledge as to current events. So people have become more aware. And what was very fortunate about this particular action was that when the four left the counter that day, there was a photojournalist that ran to take a picture of it because he heard. And he caught them just as they were coming out the door.
It's a famous photo.
A picture of the four. It's a very famous photo. So that sparked in the papers the next day. And people said, we can do this. Everyone took a spark and stand to do this, not just because it was something to do, but it's a demand for your human rights, your basic human rights to be treated equally.
How does your father's legacy impact your own activism and that of your wife?
We really seek out to continue the work of having equality for not just African American people, but for Native people. I myself am an enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. My mother is from Little Eagle, South Dakota. Her and my father met in Rapid City when he was in the Air Force. And I moved back home about 23 years ago and sat on the Tribal Council, and we're currently pretty active in Native rights and Indigenous rights and making sure that we are treated equally, not just at home on the reservations, but also in the states and in the country. Because as we know, when you look back at the history of this country, there is one group of people that were immediately excluded from the Constitution, mm-hmm. and those are the merciless Indian savages, i.e. Native Americans. So there's a lot to address when we take a look at what is to be coming down the pike. And if we are proud of the country that we live in, and we are, I am, and I think we all are, and how do we make it a better place and equality for all to live up to that creed that the Constitution states, we really must go back and address that particular Constitution. So there is a lot to address there as far as conditions on the reservation go, and that being placed in a remote location and in that system under the government, the BIA and the Department of Interior, that limits or constricts your ability to exchange commerce and movement, and also religion, which just in 1974 we were allowed to officially practice our religion again. So as the only people in this country who have been by law reduced to not be themselves, yeah, there's a lot to address. And so we're looking to do that in a very constructive way, you know, in every conversation that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are the main ones that you would like to see addressed?
There's education is controlled by the Bureau of Indian Education, Bureau of Indian Affairs, and commerce. One of the struggles that we have in on particularly, I would say, on Standing Rock, is a history or a thought that you can't make loans to natives on trust land, and the ability for a person to take a loan or to gain collateral or to build wealth is restricted due to a stereotyping of natives and the perception that banks have on natives, but particularly in trust land. So that is something that would really turn around, help us to turn things around as far as building native-owned businesses and having the economy build upon itself, particularly in our area. As like I said, we're remotely located. Standing Rock is just on the North and South Dakota border, centrally located in the state. And everywhere we go, you know, we're 70 miles south of Mandan, Bismarck. And outside of the interstate system, so making business within our own borders and turning that dollar over, it has been a challenge because every dollar that we seem to get, we bring it to Bismarck or Mobridge, mm-hmm. you know, to spend. So mm-hmm. how do we develop that community, that sense of economic strength to increase pride, stability, and ability and confidence that our children will take a look at that and see those examples and know that they can too, that they will be able to not just survive but thrive in a system and in a community that knows and loves them culturally, where we understand each other in that sense. A lot of our folks leave and never come back. You know, they find their way out there in the country and are very successful. And mm-hmm. and when they come home, they kind of go, ooh, there's nothing here. And that really is a challenge. We really need to build something so that at home there is more activity, more things to come home to.
Mm-hmm.
Not I don't want to stereotype us in a way and say economic deprivation, but, you know, 70% unemployment is a hard thing to overcome, and then there's stigma attached to that. So,
you do that work as president of Rock Industries, and that is a business development initiative to create economic development. Mm-hmm. Who are your key partners within the reservation?
We have an economic development board with Standing Rock Development Corps, and the tribe, of course, is one of our key partners. And the Development Corps is a holding company for economic enterprise, and it really has not had legs per se to stand where it can have the funds to pursue those business ventures that might, you know, benefit us. I have meetings consistently with folks wanting to do business and looking and interested in doing business and what does business look like on trust land. But vetting some of these folks, some of them are snake oil salesmen, let me say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is majority of folks looking to take advantages that think that we have tax breaks. There are a lot of misconceptions about business in on tribal land and in Indian country. And shaking that process out and working with the government can be a long process. So just in vetting those things and those proposals and training the workforce is going to be a challenge to make things successful. So,
and, of course, the Standing Rock Reservation was the site of the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which threatened the water supply of the reservation and those in the surrounding areas. How did you feel about those protests, which garnered international attention and people flocking really from around the world to come and be at Standing Rock?
I felt very thankful that people came from around the world, like you said, to come to Standing Rock to stand with us for what is our basic need. Not just our basic need, but there are folks that live across the river and down the river that didn't want to have a voice. And that always puzzled me. Where was Mobridge at? Where was Pier at? Where are these other locations at that if there's a break in the pipeline, they're going to suffer just as we would suffer? But us having a first impact on a line break, that potential line break, was a devastating thought and still is a devastating thought that we were placed in harm's way as the PSC had seemed to have a route that was going to be north of Bismarck and not put everyone in harm's way, but just put us in harm's way. That made it personal. To me, it made it personal. My in-laws and I have family that live in Cannonball and that swim in the river and fish on the river and irrigate crops from that river and get our drinking water from that river. And we're in harm's way. As of yet today, we are still in harm's way. And I pray that that never breaks because it won't only be us. It'll be everyone else downriver that will suffer. Poison, basically. And when other people came to stand and to protest and to put themselves in harm's way, I really, really was just taken aback by these young folks and older folks that came, because our kids who only know Native and white culture got to see many cultures of the world because many cultures came to stand with Standing Rock to make this position, not for greed or for commercial sake that an industry and those that own those companies can profit, but they made a stake for the people, all the people that are downstream of that pipeline. And I think in that aspect, when we look at that particular issue, is the humanity of it, not the monetary gain that we must look at this through. Sure, there are jobs. There are going to continue to be jobs. And if this pipeline was to remain a train railway, no one talks about the loss of jobs on the railway as an impact of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But how to get our product down to the Gulf seemed to be the major issue, and you know, I guess is the major issue, that in a cost-effective way, and how our treaty rights, not just our treaty rights, but our religious rights, our historical sacred sites and historical landmark sites were negated or dismissed by the state archaeological societies to just make way for this pipeline to happen. Mm-hmm. Our history goes back 12,000 years when we take a look at it. It goes back quite a ways. Just in our recent history, we have remembrances, oral history that goes back at least 2,000 years, just in current Lakota history. So that history, and it's not European, was dismissed. So that, again, goes to not just a slight to myself, but we are being treated less than human. We're being treated less than American. We're being treated less than citizens with full rights, privileges, and safeguards that all Americans count on as human, basic human rights in the greatest country of the world.
We're visiting with Joseph McNeil Jr., who will be giving the keynote address at this Monday's Martin Luther King Day observance at Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck, and that's at 7 p.m. Do you see a distinction between the racism that impacts African Americans and the racism that impacts Indigenous people?
My wife and I were discussing this because there is a difference. One is from within. The African American community were slaves to start with, had separate communities, had separate, a reflection of separate townships, basically, that the white communities had in the South, in the Mid-South, all the way up to Delaware, and all the way over to Arkansas at that time. And they had communities. I should say we have communities, because that's my daddy's side. We have those communities. And we came up from within the system to demand civil rights, to demand those rights, to make that nonviolent stand and take those hits. And you know, the violence that was extracted upon us and on that side was great, but it was up front in the news and public. What had occurred with Native Americans were called wars, when they really weren't wars. It was more a wholesale onslaught of Native American communities as what is often termed as pioneers stretched across the country to take land, to expand the country. What was basically a free-for-all for land, government subsidized or approved of that to expand the country westward. Expansion is not a term that I care to use, mm-hmm. Because it was a wholesale onslaught to the native people that were there. Now, those tribes that were hardy, I don't want to say hardy, but have the strength, like our Lakota Dakota people, to withstand that and to fight back. We were treated. We were entreated. We were made treaty with. And those treaties were, once we had agreed to those treaties, because we had that respect of the word that we were given, and those were broken. And so our lands were reduced. And then we were reduced further, and then our food was taken away, you know, the slaughter of the buffalo, and then onto the reservation, and then the Dawes Act, once we were on the reservation, reduced our ability to hold land even further, to have the settler have more land within the reservation boundaries, decreased our ability even further to have wealth, and those laws that had existed to keep us quelled exist into this day, where I was speaking of what is also referred to, well, what can be referred to as stereotyping the native culture and native ethic and native ethos on the reservations, and the ability to loan on trust land. So we're placed in a real interesting situation. Well, not interesting, in a real tough situation. And how do we make this change so that as communities, as citizens of this country, the original citizens of this country, that we have at least equal footing to have, maintain, loan, and leverage what little land we have left within our own borders.
Hmm. Are you hopeful for the future?
I am. Otherwise, we wouldn't be leaning forward. We always tilt forward, you know. Sometimes a trip, say the wrong thing, or, you know, let your anger speak. And it's not useful, you know, to be angry consistently. And how do we entreat with others so that we can recognize each other's common humanity? And in that, raise our children and smile at our grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Because one thing I see, no matter what race it is when a grandkid or a small child smiles, it makes me happy. And people look at me when I'm smiling at their kids. I'm like, I'm not going to hurt them. They're just really making me happy. It's nothing like a child's smile.
We have just over a minute and a half left, but as we're talking about this tragic but heroic legacy that you come from with the very strong Lakota people and with the actions of your father and many other civil rights leaders. I know as kids, sometimes it's easy to think, okay, Dad, you know, whatever. Okay, Mom, I'm sure that was cool. When did the power of their actions really sink in for you?
Hmm. When you have your own children. When you're looking outside of your own realm, and what it is that your life is, and when you're looking at children, what kind of future are we living for them? Are we building a future for them? That's really where it had an impact, and what they did, and where they're moving forward towards the traditions of our people, Lakota people, the Hunkpapa and all the Lakota and Dakota people, is to make decisions that will have an impact seven generations down the road. Now, that's a lot of deliberation. Just to make a wise decision, because the decision that we would come towards wouldn't reflect us. We would have to sacrifice in present day so that we can make sure that the future was certain or beneficial for our children's sake. That's our Lakota culture. And on my father's side, his was very personal. He wasn't going to stand for this. He had had enough. He had come down from New York City, where my grandma and grandpa lived in Harlem. And I have those reflections of growing up there as a young child, and then coming out here with my mom as a young child. But he went from a place of equality to coming down south and had to stand at the back of the bus line or go in the back to eat, and he just wouldn't stand for it anymore. He had to do something about it.
Joseph McNeil Jr., I'm so sorry we don't have more time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I really appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thank you so much, and I continue to listen to you guys daily. You do a fantastic job.
Thank you. Joseph McNeil Jr. will be the keynote speaker at the Martin Luther King Observance at 7 p.m. Monday the 21st at Trinity Lutheran Church in Bismarck. Still to come on Main Street, Harvest Public Media looks at the burgeoning hemp market. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Northern Plains UAS test site is beginning a new research initiative with the Federal Aviation Administration. Executive Director Nicholas Flom says after seeing beyond line of sight policies developed in 2018, the new initiative will focus on traffic management for unmanned vehicles. Flom says on average, there are 5,000 aircraft being managed in America's airspace at any given time. And he says UAVs add a new challenge.
With drones, maybe there's going to be 50,000, 500,000 at any given time. You can't do that over voice communication. You can't, you know, call somebody up and expect them to be able to reserve airspace and make sure that nobody's going to be in the area at the same time. So this is all done through an electronic means.
Flom says over the past 3 years, the test site has been actively working with NASA on the issue. He says as the new partnership with the FAA will allow the test site to help shape and form how the new system will function.
In the future, if there's package delivery that's happening, you know, in urban environment, and there's a lot of UAS that are crossing paths continually. How do we make sure that they don't run into each other? How do we make sure that if, you know, a first responder is using a UAS, they actually have, you know, clear airspace where there's not going to be any other UAS traffic that would be conflicting with, you know, the work of a first responder. All of those are going to be taken care of, you know, electronically through an unmanned aircraft traffic management system.
Flom says the first shakedown flights could begin in April and run through June. He says a final demonstration for the FAA would follow shortly after. Although the federal shutdown carries on, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced today that some local Farm Service Agency offices will temporarily reopen, including 17 offices in North Dakota. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports there will be minimal staff on hand for limited tasks.
U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue says 2,500 furloughed workers are being recalled to open up almost half of the FSA offices around the country. These locations are where farmers enroll in commodity support programs and apply for federal loans, but they'll only be open Thursday, Friday, and Tuesday. And workers will only handle loan payments and prepare tax forms for borrowers without being paid for their time. Some farmers might be wondering about meeting their deadlines to pay federal loans. The USDA says those checks aren't due until the government shutdown ends. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And a bill in the North Dakota House would treat electronic smoking devices or e-cigarettes as real cigarettes or other tobacco products. Grand Forks Democratic Representative Mary Adams is the sponsor.
It's a nicotine product, even though they don't have to say it's a nicotine product at this time, and it needs to be treated that way because it's just as addicting as cigarette smoking.
Adams says the bill means e-cigarettes would be taxed the same as other tobacco products and could only be sold in licensed establishments. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
From Minnesota to Alaska, eight rappers bring insight and emotional rawness in exploring disconnection and reconnection to Native culture. We hear personal stories that cover addiction, identity, boarding schools, and generational trauma.
I want to help preserve this language by bringing it to hip-hop.
We have to remember those seeds to our existence that have always been there.
These artists' powerful lyrical and artistic expression works to uplift their communities and inspire youth. In a four-part radio series, we hear the dynamic stories of these Native American hip-hop MCs. This is Definition of Resilience, a special from Indigify, brought to you by Native Voice One.
Coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain Time on Prairie Public Presents.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. After nearly a century of heavy state and federal regulations, hemp, a close cousin of marijuana, is now legal. From Harvest Public Media, Esther Honig reports legalization comes just in time to respond to the burgeoning hemp market.
Farmers can already grow hemp in over half of U.S. states, like Colorado, where Kristen Kuna grows hemp with her husband. Come December, there isn't much to see of her crop except a mason jar of thick, dark syrup sitting in her fridge.
Can I smell that? What is that? Does that smell more hemp-like? Or?
Kinda. Kinda sweet.
Yeah, but still a little, it smells like marijuana.
Yeah. It is cannabis.
This is CBD or cannabidiol, an oil made from hemp flowers. It's increasingly popular for its purported health benefits.
I give it to my kids. I put it on my face, burns, cuts. We've had so many different people tell us how much it's helped them.
CBD is driving the hemp market, which was once a common crop in the U.S. until lumped together with marijuana and banned in 1937. Then in 2014, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called for hemp to be grown again as part of state-run research programs. This year, he pushed to remove hemp as a controlled substance.
We believe in what we do and have been working our butt off for this. So it's really exciting. It's come this far and this is happening in our lifetime.
Like many of Colorado's hemp farmers, the Kunas have a small operation, just 1 acre. They also work day jobs. But now they can finally access bank accounts and even qualify for low-interest federal loans and crop insurance. It all comes at a time when the market for CBD is booming.
It's extremely versatile. It can be used for a whole host of different applications.
Jamie Shaw is with Brightfield Group, a market research firm. She says CBD is used in everything from lotions to sports drinks, even dog treats. Right now, that represents a modest $600 million market. But now that hemp's legal,
we know of many, many cases of massive retailers just waiting in the wings to get these products on their shelves.
As major companies like Coca-Cola take an interest, she expects hemp-derived CBD to grow into a $22 billion market in just 4 years. She says consumers are drawn in by the reported healing power of CBD.
It has treatments for everything from epilepsy to MS to arthritis to anxiety, depression, insomnia. The list goes on and on and on.
We don't know that. We don't have the clinical trial evidence to support that.
Esther Blessing teaches psychiatry at NYU. She's involved in a study to see if CBD can reduce alcohol use and PTSD symptoms. Recently, the FDA approved CBD in a drug that treats a form of epilepsy. But that's it. She says the hype around CBD has gotten a bit ahead of the research.
But on the other hand, as a scientist, I really feel like it is one of the most promising medications that has come along in the last 50 years.
Blessing says evidence from small clinical trials and animal model studies show CBD has a lot of potential. She hopes the new law will encourage more research and eventually effective medications. Meanwhile, hemp growers like the Kunas are bracing for change.
I do know everybody's going to be wanting to grow hemp and CBD, and this 1 acre is going to seem like nothing compared to people doing 10s and 30 or 50.
As more hemp is grown across the country, the price for hemp flowers will eventually drop. Kristen Kuna says they'll work to find their niche in the changing market. Esther Honig, KUNC.
Harvest Public Media is a public media collaboration reporting on America's rural and ag issues. Coming up next, a doctor in defense of good bacteria.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Dr. Allie Swabany. She is a naturopathic doctor with Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
We had you in recently on our show to talk about what naturopathy is and how that compares to and sometimes competes with and sometimes complements Western medicine. And one of the things that we talked just briefly about was bacteria, and we wanted to have you back in to talk about bacteria since it's such an enormous topic.
It is an enormous topic. Yes.
And you said something like we have how much more bacteria in our bodies than we have cells even?
I think it's something like 10 times more bacteria in our body than we have human cells. So they're a major part of our physiology and a major part of our health.
That's interesting that you say a major part of our health, because a lot of people, when they think bacteria, they just immediately think bad. But a lot of bacteria is pretty good.
Yes, a lot of bacteria is good. You know, what we're looking for in the body is a healthy variety of bacteria. That's really what makes us healthy and makes us resistant to the, quote, bad bacteria. That's how I use it in my practice, is there's the good bacteria and the bad bacteria. That's a very simplified version of what's going on in the body, because it's extremely complex. But basically, we want a environment that is highly diverse and flourishing with good bacteria. I like to think of it kind of like a garden.
I was going to say investment portfolio, but yes,
okay.
Diversity, good in gardens too.
I go to nature every time,
no, I like
don't
it.
I?
It's better.
So the idea with the garden analogy is if you have a garden that has just a couple of, say, less than vital plants in it, and it's not watered regularly, the weeds are likely to overgrow. So they may even take over the garden. you know, kill off whatever is remaining of the healthy plants. That is how I think of the ability of bacteria to come into our bodies and take over. It's when we don't have a healthy, vital garden. So if you plant a bunch of healthy plants and you nourish the soil, you provide sunshine, water, all the things that plants need to grow. Mm-hmm. There may be a few weeds that pop up, but they're not going to have the chance to take over.
Sure. And sort of like, you know, city foresters learned the lesson the hard way, you know, Dutch elm disease. If all you've ever planted along the boulevards is elm trees, you get one bad batch of Dutch elm and it wipes out everything. Whereas if you'd planted a bunch of different kinds of trees, you can fight off these illnesses.
Yeah, very good example.
Okay. So when you say a garden in our bodies, where is this garden? Everywhere?
The garden is essentially everywhere. We have bacteria on the skin, all of our mucous membranes, so nasal passages, mouth, throat. More and more you'll be seeing, and probably have already if you're watching the media, is talk about the microbiome in the digestive tract or in the gut. Really a huge percentage of the bacteria in our bodies are there. And that's a big part of what keeps us healthy or what mm-hmm. allows us to get sick.
What is the microbiome?
So the microbiome is actually just all the organisms that live in us and on us.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's the ecosystem, basically.
Yes, the ecosystem of our bodies.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sometimes if there is bad bacteria, there's an antibiotic. And sometimes if there's bad bacteria, there is the naturopathic tendency pathway, I should say, to creating that environment that makes a bad bacteria not be able to take up residence, basically, mm-hmm. in the body. But one thing that we see just a ton of in this society, and even directly in front of me, is a little bottle of hand sanitizer.
Yes. So hand sanitizer is something that's, I mean, used ubiquitously in our country and also in our hospitals and clinics. And they're starting to study the effects of that on the bacteria themselves. There's a study from the Journal of Science Transitional Medicine where they were talking about bacteria becoming more tolerant to hand sanitizers, specifically the alcohol in hand sanitizers. And so basically what they found is bacteria collected after 2009 were 10 times more tolerant to alcohol than that collected before 2004. And that actually really corresponded with the national push to use hand sanitizers in hospitals. Mm. So they're seeing a direct correlation there. And this concept is not new. For years, they've been studying the resistance of bacteria to antibiotics. Many people are familiar with MRSA and various other forms of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
The superbugs that sometimes sweep through a hospital.
The superbugs. And it's a real problem because what happens is even those last-line antibiotics, the ones they go to when they really need to get rid of a bacteria in somebody's body, those bacteria are even resistant to those last line antibiotics. So that gives them almost no options for treatment. That's scary. But it is also a place where naturopathic medicine has the opportunity to step in because we have so many ways in which we can promote the good bacteria in the body. And actually also, if we choose to go the route of trying to sort of tamp down the, quote, bad bacteria, we have a lot of ways we can do that, too, with herbal medicine, for example.
So give us some examples of herbal alternatives to things like hand sanitizers.
Sure. So I would say there's herbal alternatives to antibiotics. In terms of hand sanitizers, I mean, you might see on the shelf at you know, one of the natural food stores or supplement stores in town, there are natural hand sanitizers that use essential oils. In terms of the antibiotics, we use particular herbs for that antimicrobial effect. Mm-hmm. Common ones and ones that are really accessible would be like garlic. You know, garlic is extremely antimicrobial and very good for killing off bacteria. We also have ways in which we can replenish the good bacteria. So like I talked about that garden analogy, we're always trying to kind of create that balance, mm-hmm. And that vitality. And so, you know, we do give probiotics a fair amount of the time, and good quality probiotics can help replenish that good bacteria. And also eating fermented foods, you know, it's something we've gotten away from in our culture, but is so important to maintaining a healthy microbiome. And so eating things like cultured yogurt, kefir, kimchi, which is a Korean food, kombucha, which has gotten more popular, all of these do help to replenish the good bacteria in our guts.
If you are wanting to do it in supplement form, are there good probiotics? And maybe, you know, sometimes like if you buy a pair of cheap shoes,
yes,
that's not helping if you just get good shoes. So are there good vitamins, bad vitamins, and how do you tell the difference?
Yeah, that's a good question. There definitely are. And it the variety or the range is broad. And so with probiotics, we at our clinic carry professional lines of probiotics that we know the research on. You know, we know what's in there by the time it gets to our shelf. They're almost all refrigerated. And then a lot of the probiotics that are just on your shelf at, you know, the grocery store, the truth is we just don't know exactly how live those cultures are and how the positive impact they're going to have on your body. I wouldn't say they're necessarily dangerous to take. I would just say you might be wasting your money if you're not getting a really good quality probiotic.
Okay. Yeah. Not all yogurts are really the same.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
A lot of fermented foods, you know, like people will ask me, well, what about pickles? You know, well, I don't think if you're buying the pickles off the shelf at the grocery store, I think it's unlikely to have a lot of cultured bacteria in there. If you're making your own sauerkraut, sauerkraut, another really great fermented food, you're going to get a lot of good bacteria in there.
Okay. Well, I don't want to make hand sanitizer out to be, you know, evil and that's it.
Yes.
There are some times where hand sanitizer makes sense, I think, like if I'm camping and I'm going to use an outdoor Biffy and there's no water.
Absolutely.
Use it. What are some other times that, okay, you can use it here, here, and here, but maybe not every time you wash your hands?
Yeah, there, I think, are a lot of instances where it's really helpful. You know, I have little kids, and so I think of them playing at the playground or at the little kids' place at the mall, and then we go and eat lunch, and, you know, if we don't have access to a water, you know, a sink and soap, like they're using their hand sanitizer for that. Kids do have, yeah, lots of yuckies going on with the kids.
Yeah.
And so it makes a lot of sense to use it in that context. And there are also a lot of times I think we use it where it's not necessary. We do, I think, tend to have a fear of bacteria that's probably not accurate. Like I said, it's a natural part of our body, so it's good to have awareness of bacteria coming in that aren't necessarily benefiting us, but we don't need to be afraid of it either.
Okay. Dr. Swabany, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
And we should mention that in addition to where you practice, there is a Naturopathic Doctor Association in North Dakota that has practitioners in Fargo, Bismarck, Mandan, Minot, and Carrington. More Main Street in a moment.
Parents, students, decision makers, everybody's a stakeholder in the success of education in North Dakota.
And that is why Prairie Public Education Services has teamed up with North Dakota United, the North Dakota Department for Public Instruction, and innovation expert Ted Dintersmith for the weekly Cutting Ed podcast. Hosted by Tom Gerhart, the Cutting Ed explores education innovations in our state. You can find the Cutting Ed wherever you get your podcasts or at ndunited.org/thecuttinged.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Sky watchers are in for a trifecta of a treat this Sunday night. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Lura explains.
We could be in for a great celestial show on the evening of the 20th and early morning hours of the 21st. That's because there'll be a full moon, supermoon, and a total lunar eclipse visible over North America. If the sky cooperates, we'll be able to watch it from start to finish. That doesn't happen very often. We now know that a lunar eclipse happens when the Earth passes between the Sun and the Moon. But eclipses, both solar and lunar, must have been mysterious occurrences for early civilizations. No doubt they were a time of high anxiety and often associated with good or bad omens. Several early cultures were of the belief that something was swallowing the sun or moon, such as a demon, jaguar, or wolf. One Norse myth involved two celestial wolves, one chasing the sun and one chasing the moon. If the wolves ever caught the sun or moon, it would mark the end of the world. A lunar eclipse occurred when the wolf came dangerously close to the moon. Could the blood-red color of the moon during an eclipse indicate bloodshed? Of course, the moon, or sun, always seemed to fend off the attack. I checked timeanddate.com for the timing of the eclipse. The website lists the timing of the eclipse for Bismarck. It would be a few minutes earlier eastward, and of course a bit later and on mountain time westward. As I noted earlier, weather permitting, we'll be able to watch the eclipse in its entirety, starting with the penumbral eclipse at 8:36 p.m. in Bismarck and ending at 1:48 a.m. on the 21st. That's over 5 hours of viewing time. So even if we have some clouds in the sky, hopefully we can get some unobstructed views at some time. The partial eclipse will begin at 9:33 p.m. The full eclipse begins at 10:41 and will continue at 11:43, with a maximum occurring at 11:12 p.m. Doing the math, that's an hour and 2 minutes for totality. The partial eclipse and penumbral eclipse will end at about 12:50 p.m. and 1:48 a.m. respectively. So consider taking the time to watch all or part of this interesting lunar eclipse. And while you're at it, give some thought as to how your ancestors may have interpreted this rather uncommon astronomical event. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Prairie Public is a proud media partner for the 22nd Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music, Saturday, January 19th at the stage at Island Park. Featuring Natalie Fiddler, Diane Miller, Nina Grohlman, Lucy Michelle, Sarah Moreau, Gina Powers, Jessica Vines, and many more.
Why don't you come and sit down in that chair?
Tickets available at 22celebrationofwomen.eventbrite.com. You can find complete information on all 3 days of events at debjenkins.com/celebrationofwomen.
Strength in our number.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 16th. Remembering Theodore Roosevelt. Introduced by his favorite tune, A Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight, and featuring the words of Roosevelt, the cowboy president, as read by Steve Stark. Like all presidents before and after his time in the White House, Theodore Roosevelt weathered both ardent supporters and equally opinionated detractors in the public and the press. Yet T.R. emerged from his duties as chief executive saying no one had ever enjoyed being president as much as he did. Despite the criticisms and his tussles with newspapers, he maintained a firm conviction about the American citizen's role and even duty in evaluating presidential performance.
I have done the best that is in me. There are few harder tasks than that of filling well and ably the office of President of the United States. The labor is immense. The ceaseless worry and ceaseless anxiety are beyond description. The president is merely the most important among a large number of public servants. He should be supported or opposed exactly to the degree which is warranted by his good conduct or bad conduct, his efficiency in rendering loyal, able, and disinterested service to the nation as a whole. Therefore, it is absolutely necessary that there should be full liberty to tell the truth about his acts, and this means that it is exactly necessary to blame him when he does wrong as to praise him when he does right. Any other attitude as an American citizen is both base and servile. To announce that there must be no criticism of the president or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally reprehensible to the American public. Nothing but the truth should be spoken about him or anyone else, but it is more important to tell the truth, pleasant or unpleasant, about him than about anyone else. Our duty is entirely to the United States. It is due to the president only and exactly to the degree in which he serves the United States. It is our duty to support him when he serves the United States well. It is our duty to oppose him when he serves it badly. I believe he should be sharply watched by the people, held to a strict accountability by them, and that he should not keep the office too long.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
25 years ago, Los Angeles was hit by a massive earthquake. Buildings collapsed, freeways were destroyed.
There were also flames coming out of the water. I mean, how often do you see that?
Los Angeles was caught unprepared, so will they be ready for the next one?
It could take us decades to recover what we lose.
Plus, we'll hear more on government workers surviving the partial shutdown on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, growth, and especially rapid growth, can present problems and opportunities. From this week's Prairie Pulse television show, we learn about how the West Fargo school system is dealing with tremendous growth. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.